so good. They stone you just like they said they would. They stone you when you're trying to go home. And they'll stone you when you're there all alone. But I would not feel so all alone.
You're listening to Talking Travel, your number one source for travel news, reviews, and in-depth travel journalism. Broadcasting live from Florida's Sun Coast on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Don't forget you can listen to us online 24/7 at ttrn.com. And now, here's the travel guys, Marcus and Roy. Hey!
Well, good morning. It's Roy Lowy, and welcome to Talking Travel. And we have, as usual, a great lineup of guests. Today, Mr. Evan Eggers, president of O2Cruise.com, the Internet's cruise superstore, with his latest on the cruise scene, will be with us. And Mr. D.T. Minnick, who is the executive director of Lee County Visitors and Convention Bureau, is going to give us an update on Wilma, which is, I think, very important at this particular stage of the game. Syndicated columnist and National Geographic ombudsman Christopher Elliott, with his point of view about major airlines and their lost cost offsprings, or I should say not their lost cost, but going to be lost cost, especially song. And we'll kick that around. Travel journalist Carol Matthews will discuss her grassroots article, The Secret Gardens of London. And associate producer Bob Fisher is going to bring us another destination, Canada, on Saskatchewan. So it's we've got a really great lineup today. And we have Mr. Evan Eggers on the phone. So why don't we go straight to Mr. Evan Eggers, who is president of O2Cruise.com. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Roy. How are you?
I'm terrific.
Well, you'll be amused to know my computer just crashed, so there you go.
Uh-oh, gee, does that happen to you very often? Or?
No, only when it's really important for it not to does it happen.
Well, I hope all your information isn't on there. I always try and print mine out just in case the computer does go down.
Yeah, well, now I've learned my lesson. But no, it's no problem. We still have good stuff to talk about, computer or no computer.
Well, in fact, if you like, you sent me some notes, and we can kind of go through them. And I think a couple of things. One, as you mentioned, the Cozumel situation is in a bit of a mess and probably will be closed for 2 or 3 months, I believe you said.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the latest news from Cozumel. They're not exactly sure yet, but the piers are probably closed for at least 2 months. And, you know, the cruise lines are all working around it in the Western Caribbean, doing things like visiting Playa del Carmen, Costa Maya instead, in Carnival's case, or Norwegian, who is sailing from Houston. They're going to a Belize and Roatan, Honduras instead. So, you know, it's important for people to know, but it's really no reason to avoid the Western Caribbean unless you were, for some reason, wedded to the idea of going to Cozumel, because these other ports are, you know, they're delightful. So, and obviously we wish Cozumel the best in getting everything put back together and ship shape.
Now, I guess Cozumel is one, but what about Cancun? Is Cancun okay? I didn't really go through that.
You know, Cancun is still, I'm hearing mixed messages out of Cancun. On the one hand, the Convention Visitors Bureau in Cancun is saying, we're open, come visit us.
Yeah.
At the same time, I don't believe they're accepting ships yet, although I'd have to double check that. And there is going to be some delay there as well. So it's not clear on how much is marketing thinking on the part of the Convention and Visitors Bureau. I'll wait until we have some customers come back and tell us firsthand cruise ship, what's going on.
Exactly, because the other part of that is maybe the port's open, but what about all those shops and what about the rest of the place? It's still not in any kind of condition to really deal with the tourists as they have been dealing with them.
Yeah, and not that I'm suggesting this is the case. I'll tell you a very short, funny story. I live in New England, as you know, and one day I was driving to Boston's Logan Airport in a snowstorm to catch a flight. And the fellow who was Logan's spokesperson is on the news radio saying, the airport is open, everything's fine. When I get there, I actually had a friend who worked at United at the time who told me, yeah, the airport's open, but they haven't plowed the taxiways yet.
Yeah, incredible.
So I don't think that's going on here, just to be clear. But
well, there for a while, they were only taking flights in the daytime because they couldn't operate at night.
That's right. That's right.
And that's what all the confusion was about, and that's what all the complaints were about. But you know, you can say what you want about the airlines, and you can blame it on whoever you want. But if you can't land, you can't land. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right, exactly.
There were a couple other interesting items, and one, of course, is the new Mrs. Trump.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Norwegian picks the most enjoyable godmothers for their ships, and in the case of the Norwegian Jewel, which is being christened here shortly, they've chosen Melania Trump.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a lot of fun, and I remember I was on the Norwegian Dawn inaugural. That was Kim Cattrall. So I tell you, Norwegian Cruise Line, they know how to throw a party for their inaugural. They most certainly do.
They sure do.
And they pick the personalities to suit.
Yeah, exactly.
So that should be interesting to see how that pans out.
Now, let's talk about the holidays and the cruises. Let's touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, people have probably heard, which is totally true, that cruising is going gangbusters. Prices are higher than they have been in the past. Availability is scarcer. And interestingly, though, there is still space available on holiday cruises. And by holidays, we mean the big ones for cruising are Thanksgiving and even more so Christmas and New Year's. New Year's is probably the most expensive time of the year to take a cruise. Now, there is some interesting stuff going on right now. Holland America, as your listeners may know, has something they call the five-day flash every week where they have special rates that only last for the course of a week. And they are featuring Christmas cruises this week. So, in fact, and this is, goes counter to everything that we know in the travel business, really, that the best pricing you can get for an inside stateroom right now for a Christmas cruise, 7 nights or longer, a 7-night Christmas cruise, is on Holland America this week.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
And, you know, the rate's only good this week. It's on the Volendam sailing to the Western Caribbean, and the inside rates start from $649 per person, double occupancy, which is just unbelievable for a Christmas cruise.
So the advice is get on the horn if you want to get away for the holidays. There's still space available, and there might even be some good deals still available.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a wonderful way to travel. You've got no hassles of cleaning and cooking and all that nonsense, and the cruise lines really do it up right on board. And and people who are interested in just browsing through what's available, if they go to o2cruise.com, right on our homepage, we have a thing called Special Occasion Trips. With one click, you can see all the cruises that are available that sail over these holidays. So makes it easy.
Well, that's good advice, Evan, and we thank you for that. And I did the holidays with my family, and I can only tell you it's just the best.
It is. It's all the fun with none of the stress. It's beautiful.
Exactly. Thanks again, and we'll be looking forward to talking to you next week.
Have a great show, Roy.
Thanks.
Bye.
Well, that was Mr. Evan Eggins. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Mr. D.T. Minnick, who is the executive director of the Lee County Visitors Bureau, and he's going to update us on what's happening there. Hold on, and we'll be right back.
Totally gone native. Totally playful. Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks, all-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot, yeah, time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah.
Well, we're back, and we're joined by Mr. D.T. Minnick, who is the Executive Director of the Lee County Visitors and Convention Bureau. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us, and I appreciate you taking the time with us today, because it is so important at times like these to get a clear, precise information out to the general public? Because, as you know, after Hurricane Charley, people had the misconception that the whole state of Florida was in a shambles. And so, if you will, please share with our worldwide audience today the latest on Lee County, if you will.
Well, first of all, I'd really like to say thank you for taking the time and going to the effort to find out how we're doing. We are really back to complete normalcy here. This storm did very little damage structurally here in Lee County. For the most part, it was just signage that was blown down, some traffic lights, and a lot of limbs and things like that. But pretty much everything is back up and running. All of the hotels are welcoming guests. The beaches have been open for several days now, and power's been restored to pretty much 100% of the county. And in fact, the reports from the beaches are that the shelling has never been better for, they can't remember how many years that they've seen shelling like this. So it actually brought a lot of shells up onto the beach.
Well, it was interesting because we spoke to somebody from Sanibel last week, and he was saying the same thing. They said the beaches are fantastic. People are finding shells that they haven't seen in years, and their power had just gone, you know, come back on last week. And they said, as you're saying, the damage was peripheral. They lost some shingles off their roofs, but on a scale of 1 to 10 compared to Charley, this was like a 2.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree. And the other thing was that when this thing went through, after that, it was followed by our first welcome cold front of the season. And of course, down here, when we're talking cold front, we're talking that the temperature went down into the
middle 50s.
Middle 50s at night, and it was about 80 degrees, but very little humidity. And so the weather has just turned phenomenal. The nice winter weather is here finally. So we're very pleased about that as well. And lots of bright blue sky and sunshine.
Well, that's great to hear. What about, are all the resorts open? Because some of them really never opened after Charley, on Captiva.
South Seas Resort is still closed. And that's still due to Charley. The damage, they took the opportunity not just to fix the damage that they received from Charley, but to just totally reconfigure the whole resort itself. So they're going, every unit is being redone. They totally redesigned all the public areas. They filled in the swimming pool, the existing swimming pools, and redesigned all these different swimming pool configurations, and so they're taking their time, but they're doing it right. And this storm really didn't affect progress or construction or anything like that, and they're still looking at a February grand opening for this coming February.
I think they're even planning on coming out with a new name, aren't they?
Yes, they're redoing the advertising, the logos, everything. So And it's a spectacular setting, so it's going to be fantastic, and we just keep telling people it's going to be worth the wait.
Well, so for our listeners, and of course this show streams worldwide, we just like you to know that as I hear it, Lee County is up and running as usual, and just waiting for everybody with open arms. Is that the way you'd sum it up?
Absolutely, we're open for business. We have the international sand sculpting contest coming up November 11th, 12th, and 13th, and we've got some great sculptors coming down, and the weather's great, and everything looks good, and the shelling's wonderful, and we'd love for anyone to come down and visit us on the beaches of Fort Myers and Sanibel.
DT, for our listeners, can you just give us your website so people can, I'm sure you have updates and
sure,
all of that.
Sure, yes, absolutely. It's Fort Myers -sanibel.com.
Okay, and there's also an 800 number, I believe, and I think I even have that. It's 800-237-6444, is that correct?
Correct, yep, and we'll be glad to send anyone a visitor guide, or they can go online and check out the website.
All right, was there anything else you'd like to get across to everyone out there before we go to break?
No, I just, we're
You're welcome ready.
Guest. We're ready. Come on down and see us.
All right. Well, we sure don't want the same thing to happen with this misconception that everybody had last time around that, oh, no, don't go to Florida. It's a mess, because that's not the case. I happen to broadcast, even though we broadcast worldwide, from Sarasota, and it's beautiful here. The only interesting thing is we had this strange phenomena. We didn't know what happened to our ocean and our bay. For some reason or other, it receded for about a quarter of a mile, and I think that's why people were being able to find shells. People even said, yeah, I found an old anchor I lost last year. And it was just absolutely incredible, I was hoping the tide would come in before they built some more condominiums out there. But it, as you say, everything is beautiful here. The sun's out. It's cool in the evening, and come on down. Lee County's ready for you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
It's a pleasure. We talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, as you can hear, everything's ready in Lee County. And it looks like, other than the property on Captiva, everything is back to normal, and we thank Mr. Minnick for bringing us that information. We're going to go to break, and as soon as we come back, Mr. Chris Elliott is going to be with us, and we're going to chat about the fading of Delta's low-cost carrier song. So stay with us.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
I'm a traveling man, made a lot of stuff all over the world.
Well, we're back, and we are with a bit of a traveling man, Mr. Chris Elliott, and we're pleased to have him with us. And Chris is a syndicated columnist and National Geographic Ombudsman. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. I couldn't be better, especially when I'm chatting with you.
That's nice of you to say.
Chris, if you could just speak up into the phone a little. I'm just having a little problem hearing you. But, you know, there's Delta's song will shortly be a song in history. And the question I wanted to put to you, do you think it was just a case of a horse of a different color is still a horse?
Yeah, you know, there was the whole joke going on that when the last regime at Delta cleared out, one of the executives said that they should have put the word swan in front of song. But I think that they just got the name wrong. You know, with the success of Hooters Air, maybe they should have called it thong instead.
Very, very good. You know, the whole thing is that I think the concept of competing with the JetBlues and the rest of it is a good concept. But, you know, don't call yourself something interesting because you think you're going to lower the salaries of the pilots, and you have to really go back to basics to do that. So I think they would have just been better off if they were competing in a market just to drop the prices than to spend all the money they did to put something together that didn't work.
No, it's. I was talking with an executive at Delta yesterday, and they are, you know, they made this decision very reluctantly. I got the feeling. Delta is the airline. Is our song, I should say, is the airline that Delta should have been. And the idea going forward is that they're going to make Delta much more like Song was, which is to say, you know, maybe spiff up the uniforms, make the seats better, improve the in-flight entertainment. that sort of thing. And you know, there were a lot of things about Song that people really liked.
Right.
But there were a lot of things that their highest revenue customers did not like, and that was their business travelers didn't like the fact that there was no first class. And they were not able to make a lot of money off the flights either because they, you know, they didn't have those premium seats. So I think that they really had to go back to the drawing board and say, well, as the kind of airline that we are, Delta is not a low-fare carrier. And what they were doing was behaving like a low-fare carrier. And so now they're what I think they're doing is folding the best of what they found at Song into the rest of mainline Delta, which I think is a fairly good idea. You know, if you talk about all of these airlines that started right after 9/11, the airlines within airlines like United's TED and Delta Song, those two were, you know, on very different tracks. And if you talk to the analysts, actually Song would have been given a much better chance of survival because it did a lot of things that, by separating some of the traffic, it did, and having this brand differentiation. It did things that I think would have made it successful if it weren't for a bankruptcy filing by Delta. So it's just a very unfortunate thing. I personally actually liked Song a lot.
Well, do you think United is going to end up going the same direction with TED?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I've talked to the guys who are running TED, and even though you have analysts saying that TED really is smoke and mirrors,
right,
and it's just a different paint job on the same plane.
Mm-hmm.
United is still standing by TED and saying we're going to keep it going. I just don't see how they can keep it going for much longer. It's just it doesn't make very much sense at all. Then again, they haven't really invested that much money. I think all told, it's been a couple of million dollars that they've invested in it. So maybe it really is a little bit more of a, I don't know, publicity stunt than Song was.
Well, you know, Delta's really never said whether Song made any money or not, actually.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So we don't even know.
We do not know. I mean, you talk to some of the folks who, you know, do know, and I think that they would have said something if they were making money. Instead, they say things that are a little bit more euphemistic, like we're pleased with our results, which means it could be losing. One thing that can be said, and that people have told me, is that it's losing less money than mainline Delta was losing, which for Delta was good enough at the time, but now it just doesn't cut it anymore because now they're in bankruptcy. Now they have to really make some very serious cuts. So. I think it's fairly safe to say that Song never made any money, but it made a lot of friends.
Well, I think you're right, and it brought a lot of attention to all of this. I think the cutoff date is May 2006,
right,
I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. They're gonna start flying those planes with a two-class configuration, so they'll have a first class, and then they're going to kind of Songify, if that's even a word, the rest of their fleet. You know, Delta right now is really involved in shifting its focus from the domestic market to the international market. I read a statistic somewhere that it's the largest international carrier now.
Right.
And if it is not, then it will be soon because I my sources within Delta tell me that they're going to be launching even more international flights and routes soon. So.
I think that's true of a number of the carriers, and it kind of opens up another door, doesn't it, that for the regional carriers, whether they be low cost or just plain regional, that if the major carriers are starting to go to the long haul, there's going to be some other opportunities here.
Well, you are seeing a shakeout already now. I don't know what kind of opportunity. I think the opportunities will be for the airlines that have found a way of making a profit in the past, like Southwest and even JetBlue, to expand. I think you see the mainline carriers kind of giving up and saying, you can have the domestic market. Maybe we'll take Transcon, you know, in a couple of smaller routes, but, you know, the bread and butter that really kind of the routes that sort of they built their entire airline on, they're giving those up to the JetBlues and the Southwests of the world.
Right, exactly. I just sort of note that when Delta launched Song in 2003, they actually spent $65 million getting Song off the ground.
You know, I asked Song about that, and I'd have to go back to my notes, but I don't know if it was $65 million. I think it may have been a little bit less than that, they said. But it depends how you slice and dice that figure. I mean, I think that if you include all the promotion, the marketing, and the new Kate Spade uniforms and the paint jobs and all that, it may well have exceeded that. But
well, and then if you take the cost of, say, an airplane you already have, and you move the cost of that airplane over mm-hmm. onto the other one, so I mean it's really a numbers game. It's hard
yeah.
to say, isn't it?
Well, it would have been really great if Delta had some kind of transparency with Song and had broken out the financial results, because then we would have all known how it was doing. And it's a shame, because I really do think, I have flown on Song many times and I really liked it, and I am, you know, I'm a skeptic. If the experience is bad, I'd be the first to say it, but they really did a lot of things right, and I'm going to miss Song.
Yeah. Go through some of those if you will.
Sure. Well, the thing about Song is the first thing you notice is the color scheme. It's kind of a lime green
right.
paint job.
Yeah, I wasn't too excited about that, but
no. I think a lot of people didn't like that either. It was very, actually, when they created Song, they did a lot of focus groups, and they were aiming this airline at women who make a lot of travel purchasing decisions.
And women like lime green.
I don't, you know what? Maybe lime green was the in color. Who knows? But then there was also the leather seats, which is something that JetBlue. Really did well,
right.
You know, those seats last a lot longer too. So they're going to be Delta's going to have those on a lot of its planes
right.
now.
And not only were the seats leather, but they were comfortable. There's something
they
about
were.
Them. Yeah,
that's right. They gave us a little extra seat pitch, and I'm concerned that when they go to a two-class configuration, that we're going to see some of that seat pitch disappear in the back of the plane. But you know, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Hopefully, they'll do the right thing. Then there was the in-flight entertainment system. I don't know if you've ever flown on Song, but you were able actually to play trivia games with everyone else on the plane. It was really cool. They had sort of you could watch satellite television, you could pay for a movie, or you could play these trivia games like you play in the bar. You
yeah,
know,
I was going to say in some of the sports bars they yeah. have that, right? And you can play with other bars. Yeah, that's really really cool.
It was really. I've won that a couple of times. There's no feeling like beating everyone else on the plane at a trivia game. then you had the uniforms, the Kate Spade uniforms that I mentioned already, and you had also little touches that would it just be unimaginable at Delta, at a mainline Delta, on a mainline Delta flight. For example, the in-flight announcements were often sung, and they had this really great soundtrack. And I did a story for NPR about about Song and Ted, and they sent me one of the CDs. And
right.
one of them sounds like Barry White, you know.
Right.
It's very, you know, that very deep voice, and it's a real kind of a soul groove, and he does all the in-flight announcements and talks about where the exits are, but he's singing it the whole time, and you have the flight attendants are kind of shaking along. It's
right.
It's really funny. Then there was the food, and the food actually got a lot of rave reviews from people, because they invested in some gourmet food that you paid for it, but it was worth paying for. They had, you know, a very generous breakfast. They had sandwiches, like chicken sandwiches. And it was just a real nice flying experience. I've flown them up to New York, and I've also flown them out to California. And you know, the whole flight, the five-hour flight goes by so quickly because you're watching satellite TV, and it's just great.
Well, the thing is that that's certainly a learning process, I would think, for the airline, for the responses that they got for that, and there's no reason why they can't carry that over to the existing carrier.
They're, right. Well, one of the problems is cost. To retrofit the entire fleet is going to be very expensive, and Delta is in bankruptcy.
Right, well, of course. But, I mean, I think that certainly the idea of the interchange, the singing, all of that kind of thing, that can still carry over, I would think.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, anyway.
When I was, when song first got started, what I like to do when I fly is to go hang out in the back and
right.
talk to the flight attendants. And,
by the galley, yeah.
Yeah, in the galley. And apparently, you didn't just apply for a transfer to song. You had to go through a fairly rigorous interview process, and you were chosen for song. So they picked the flight attendants that had the best attitudes. Now, I got to tell you, there are flight attendants at Delta who've been there for a long time. They have maybe a less than productive attitude. It's more of an attitude of entitlement. And I'm not saying that they're all this way, but
yeah.
There are a few curmudgeons that are still working those planes. And those were the ones that had to stay behind at Mainline Delta. And so now, there's some flight attendants, I can't imagine them dancing the merengue in the aisles. Just, it's going to be real tough to get them to do that.
Well, I think we're going to have to wait a little while and see what happens. And but, it was a great experiment, and it's unfortunate that it didn't work. But, let's just hope it's a lesson learned. Chris, we've got to go. Thank you very much for taking the time and chatting with us. It's always interesting. And good luck with you. I love the way your trip show is coming together. It really looks good.
Oh, thanks. That's nice of you to say. And just as a reminder, our URL is www.tripso.com.
That's it. And if you're not getting it, make sure you do. You'll enjoy it. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Chris Elliott, an interesting man, a fair man, and I think with his consumer advocacy, he really looks into it, and he'll get into it, chase down what your problem is. But, if you're not right, he's going to tell you so. And I appreciate that and everything that Chris does. And he's also a great writer. We've got to go to break. And when we come back, Carol Matthews will be with us. So stay tuned.
Totally gone native. Totally playful. Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks. All-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again.
Well, we're back, and we're joined by a very interesting lady by the name of Carol Matthews, and she's our grassroots resident garden journalist. Now, that's a mouthful, actually, but Carol really puts together some really great stuff, and today she has a marvelous story, and it's Discovering the Secret Gardens of London. Good morning, Carol.
Hello, Roy. How are you?
I'm terrific, and I really love your article. And I've been to London a lot of times, and I've never seen these places. So let's just chat about it, if you will.
Okay. Well, as you say, I mean, everybody's familiar with Kew Gardens, with St. James Park, and with the Kensington Palace Gardens, but very few people have heard of these ones, and I was just fortunate to find them. They're a little bit smaller gardens, but they're really, really interesting, and they have a lot of history associated with them.
Now,
you want me to start?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you talk about some of these gardens, like Captain Bligh of the Bounty and the Prince of Wales have in common, and you say they're all associated with little-known gardens, and some of them start out. Was the Westminster Abbey College Garden, I guess, is the first one.
Yes. Well, it's a not very well known at all, to be honest, among, you know, average tourists going over. And it's only open at certain times, so you have to double check. It's open every week, but only at certain times.
Right. What got me stuttering there was Captain Bly planted, right? You know, I'm looking for the word buried, and we're talking planted, and I'm saying, well, wait a minute, did I use the wrong word there? But
no.
Continue on, I'm sorry.
Okay, so the Westminster Garden there's been a garden on that site for over 9 centuries, over 900 years, and it's still basically the same sort of garden. It's an herb garden. They were grown to treat the monks if there were any illnesses, or even the general people in the area would come, and the monks would treat them for illnesses as well,
right,
with the medical plant.
Uh-huh. So you say the first secret garden is sandwiched between Royal Hospital Road and the Chelsea Embankment.
Right. The Chelsea Embankment runs along the Thames,
right,
River.
Uh-huh.
So it's a really, really nice garden. And don't you love the name Swan Walk of the street that it's
on?
Oh,
yes, lovely.
Well, and it's also an enclosed garden. It's totally surrounded by a brick wall, and it's got to be probably 12 feet tall. So it's truly a mystery because you can't see anything, maybe just the top of a few trees, until you're inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. It's been there since 1673, so it's another old garden full of history, but it has all kinds of beautiful things to see and exciting things to discover.
And originally it was maintained for the study and cultivation of plants for medicinal purposes, is that correct?
That's right, and also to train people to identify herbalists and apothecaries to identify the plants if they went out to collect them, say, in nature or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's just, you say behind the Sloan statue is a,
yes,
pond surrounded by Europe's oldest rock garden.
Isn't that fun?
It's incredible.
I love, you know, rock gardens are interesting, and especially if there's a pond in the middle, it really makes them interesting. But this one, when you find out that it has built from stones from the Tower of London, from Icelandic lava brought to England in the ballast of ships, fused bricks from row houses, some of them that were demolished in fires and that sort of thing, and then flint, which was sort of a filler in castles.
Right.
I mean, between castle walls. And so it's quite the unusual rock garden. There's more to it than the plants, which are lovely, but it's really interesting.
Now, you go on to say that behind the statue, on one side of the main lawn, while on the other is the fascinating garden of world medicine.
Yes, this is really something. You walk through this area, and each bed is separated. It represents a different country or area in the world. There's from Australia, there's North America, and all this sort of thing. And then they have the plants that the indigenous people used for their medication or whatever, you know, back through history. And it's interesting how times change and how science or other things find, you know, bring you to other understandings. For instance, the North American Indian used tobacco as one of their medicinal plants.
Right. And what is also interesting that these people traveled, you know, these great distances to South Africa and Northern Europe and the Mediterranean, Australia, to collect this.
I know. Isn't that amazing? I mean, we think you can only get to places by flying.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Now.
Can you imagine how long it took these people to put this?
Oh, it would be a year's trip to go on some of these things.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was a major commitment and passion, obviously, for people to do that.
Right. It's incredible. I mean, absolutely incredible. Now, to move along,
yes,
you say close by is the pharmaceutical garden.
Yes. Now, in contrast to the one before, which was ones that were used but not necessarily proven, the next one is the pharmaceutical garden, and these are medicinal plants that are in use today.
Right.
And they're divided into the different areas of medicine, such as psychiatry and cardiology and that sort of thing. So it, you know, we seem to think, well, not everyone, but some people seem to think that, you know, the pill comes and it's all some kind of chemical, but it actually came from something living and growing.
And meadowsweet, which has a name that I can't pronounce, is the plant that you say is really where aspirin came from.
That's right.
And that was in 1835.
Okay. Oh, well, yes. It was first made in 1835, and then aspirin was introduced in 1899, yes.
Incredible. And it's just so marvelous that the thing that amazes me so much, Carol, is that I've never seen any of this, unless I just haven't looked closely on any of the, you know, the tourist maps. I mean, is there a reason for that, or
what for these?
For these gardens, either I missed it, or in all the times I've been to London, I haven't been to these.
Oh, great! Well, they're there, but they're not the first thing people look for, I guess. Although I do believe that everybody has an interest in a garden for some reason or other. Every garden has a story, and it can grab you from some angle.
Exactly.
But they are there, but you kind of have to dig and ask.
Well, let's continue on down the Thames.
Okay. There is the first museum of garden history in the world. Was started there in 1977. And it had two reasons to be. One was to reclaim an old church that had been deconsecrated and was going to be demolished, and it was such a beautiful church they wanted to save it. So they decided the reason the people who did it, they would make it into a garden history museum, because England is so tied up in its gardening.
Now this is right next to Lambeth Palace. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yes. Yeah.
Right, and for those that are listening, in Carol's articles, she points out that it's right across from Big Ben in the English Parliament building, so that shouldn't be hard to find. You just have to find the garden.
That's right. You just have to cross the river,
right.
Cross the river, and find the garden. But it's also, I'll tell you, just in a little aside, it's a great place to take pictures of the Parliament building, because you're far enough away, you can get the whole thing in.
Right.
When you're on the other side of the river, you're too close to get it all in one picture.
Very true. Very, very true. So let's continue on.
Okay. This museum is fascinating, both inside and out. Inside, I don't know if you had a chance to look up the, where is it here?
The website.
Oh, pardon?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. The Lamb of Tartary.
Yes.
It's hilarious. It's an artifact. It's a collection that's at the museum, and it's called the Vegetable Lamb of Tartary, and folklore described it as a cross between a vegetable and an animal.
Yeah, how strange.
Sturdy stem. The top of it resembled a fluffy lamb, and supposedly it was anchored to the ground, and it fed on the surrounding vegetation until that was all gone, and then the lamb would wither and die on the stem. Now, until the 18th century, this vegetable lamb of Tartary was considered one of the natural wonders of the world. But since then, it's been identified as a fern found in Russia that has, on the stem is very strong and sturdy, but on the top it sort of has rootlet-type things. And so it's all fuzzy and looks like a lamb. That was hilarious when you saw it.
I would think that it's just an amazing story.
Yes, and then there's lots of other things inside, tools, and there's a library that has fascinating things. But also outside is a lot of scattered tombs and grave markers, because it's a church that's been there for four centuries. And that is also where Captain Bligh has his tomb, Captain Bligh of the Mutiny on the Bounty.
Right.
But they have also recreated a 17th century knot garden. And it commemorates two famous gardeners whose tomb is also there, the Tradescants. And there's a father and son, and they were both gardeners to Charles I and Charles II of England. And they also traveled the world to collect plants to bring back. So this garden is a memorial to them, and it's also built in the design of a 17th century garden.
And now, this, other than the medicinal, this has roses and perennials.
Yes, yes. And it's also really, if you can see the sort of above-ground view of it,
uh-huh.
any knot garden, it's just gorgeous. And it has two teas planted on each side, usually in sort of a gray or an artemisia color that stands for the Trasidens.
Now, you say the last garden has been in existence for over nine of them, speaking of centuries.
That's
and
right.
And the Westminster Abbey College Garden.
Yes. Yes, this is a delightful little garden. It's totally surrounded by buildings, so it can't be seen from the street either. And it was started in the 11th century to provide medicinal herbs for the abbey monks and the local people. And they also grew food for the abbey. So they had fruit trees and grapevines and vegetables.
Well, grapevines are very important in abbeys.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's where you make your wine.
That's right.
And what would an abbey be without a nice glass of wine, that's for sure.
Wonderful.
Now, so you say it's only accessible through the abbey's little cloister.
Yes, and the little cloister is a treasure in itself. It's it's surrounded by the building,
right.
by the abbey building, the stone walls. But it's sort of an open-to-the-sky little square area that has a lovely fountain in the middle and perennials all around the inside edge of the square. Now, there's the four north, south, east, west angles or sides, and you have to plant different plants in each one because of their location and the amount of sun they get. But they're all identical in the color scheme, so you don't really notice that they're entirely different because the colors are all the same. And then outside of that is this wonderful ironwork archways with sort of the almost lacy design. It's just beautiful, very tranquil, and it's a lovely spot.
Well, the next time I go to London, I'm taking this article with me, and I suggest anybody that's going there do the same. You can go to our website, ttrn.com, and click on Grassroots, on the Grassroots button. I'm getting tongue-tied here this morning. and you can view Carol's article. And she also mentions, just before we go, three websites, and one is the Chelsea Physic Garden, and you can you best get it from the website because some of these things are a little bit difficult to to mention. But there is one, info@westminster-abbey.org, and the other, info@museumgardenhistory.org. That's an easy one to remember. But it's all on the website. Carol, we've got to run. Once again, thank you very much. It was really lovely article, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
My pleasure, Roy. Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Carol Matthews always has something different and interesting. And, you know, we all travel and we all do all of those things, but do we really take the time to find some of this? Carol finds it for us, and it's up to us to take advantage of that. And next time you're in London, check out these gardens. We're going to break, and when we come back, Associate Producer Bob Fisher will be with us with another interesting Destination Canada.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
Associate Producer Mr. Bob Fisher is with us today. I didn't have my sound pushed up there. And he's going to bring us another Destination Canada. And it's top of the morning to you, Bob.
And the rest of the day to you, sir.
You got it right.
Did I say that right?
Well, you got it exactly right. And, okay. And you're not even Irish.
Well, way back.
Way back.
You know, there's nothing more Irish than an Irish-American. Or an
and there's nothing more Irish than everybody on St. Patrick's Day.
That's right.
Now, today we're going to talk about Saskatchewan, and in your words, it's one of the friendliest destinations in North America, where you can sit on your porch and watch your dog run away for 3 days. Let's start with that.
Yeah, that's the quintessential Saskatchewan joke, and it is true. I should mention, by the way, Roy, I'm going to talk a mile a minute here because this was one of the best travel experiences I've had in the last 12 months.
Well, we're here to listen.
It's pretty close to home to me, but I just want to point out, first of all, that 2005 is Saskatchewan's centennial. Saskatchewan actually became a province of Canada, a full province of Canada in 1905, and it was created from what was then called the Northwest Territories. And just, I'm just giving folks a little bit of a perspective here, because the Northwest Territories is where the Mounties came from, and they were originally called the Northwest Mounted Police. Today, of course, they're the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
And his dog King.
Yeah, but his dog King.
Sergeant Preston.
Rosemary, you know the whole thing.
Well, we know Sergeant Preston, of course.
Hey, you're talking.
I mean, we grew up, we're south of the border, but we grew up with Sergeant Preston.
It's funny, I met a lot of Americans when I was in Saskatchewan. Who told exactly those kinds of stories. But it's been a great year for Saskatchewan. Obviously, it's been a terrific party for them. It's ongoing, and there's so much that's going on out there. But, you know, what really struck me about this, now that we have started the new feature, Rediscovering America, Travel Treasures Close to Home, on the show and going to great places like the Finger Lakes and I was down in Lee County, which I'm going to be talking about. It's got me back into the Rediscovering Canada Travel Treasures Close to Home mode. And even though we do the Destination Canada feature, but when I got to Saskatchewan last June, I was there in early June, it really brought it home to me how important it is to go back to some of the places that in your own country that you've been to, or maybe you've never been to before.
Well, you make a very bold prediction, and that is that Saskatchewan will become the next big travel discovery in North America.
And you know what? I really believe that. I really believe that. Because Saskatchewan, if we look at the market, and I was really interested in the discussion between you and Chris, but we have to look at the market. What's happening globally in terms of travel? What do people want? What are they looking for? Well, we know that the 50-plus demographic is the most important in the industry.
Yes.
Now, and this is a demographic of people who really want a renewed perspective on life, on all things, but especially on travel. And but they want to get there. They want to get there in comfort. This is Saskatchewan. It's a when you go to Saskatchewan, you will get a renewed sense of space. And I mean geographical, topographical space, because it is the northern limits of the Great Plains of North America.
Well, you say it's not unlike places like Montana and the Great Plains of the U.S., big sky country.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, it is big sky country. And, you know, and I think this is important because most of us are living in urban areas, and we don't see the sky. If we see the sky, it tends to be gray. When you're in Saskatchewan and in big sky country, you know, if I just take that, the sky is the most intense, deep blue. You can almost penetrate it. But the other space that you really discover in Saskatchewan, certainly that I did, is a personal sense of space. You really, once again, you get to sit back and you look around you and say, okay, where am I in relationship to, and here it comes because this is the title of the article, where am I in relationship to the land mm-hmm. and the landscape? And do you have any idea, do you know what I'm saying when I say in the article, learning from the landscape?
No, absolutely, because I traveled a great deal, and it's very close to my heart.
Yeah, and this is what really Saskatchewan as prairie country is all about. It's the heart and the soul of this, what I say is a spectacular part of Canada, and is spectacular. It's omnipresent in the land, and the land and the landscape determine the people of Saskatchewan, their values, their traditions, but more importantly, a very intense interdependent relationship with the prairie, with the land. This was not, for people that immigrated here, it was not an easy place to come to. Because, first of all, it's in the geographical center of Canada and of North America, by the way.
Exactly.
Capital city, Regina, I believe, is the city that's the most geographically centered on the continent. I know people that go to the prairies, and they actually experience a kind of cultural shock because it is so open. There is so much space. And people have been known to actually suffer agoraphobia, and they can't even get out of the car. But once you start to just sit back and look at this space and really appreciate it and think about it, there's this kind of transformation that occurs. You leave behind that other space that you know so well. And you begin to develop a new relationship with the environment. Saskatchewan was also, and the Great Plains, as we know, was great First Nations territories. 10,000 years ago, the first Aboriginal people, of course, were living on this land and living from the land, and especially from, in Canada we call them now the bison, but the buffalo. This was where, the buffalo
roamed.
Right.
And
even today, rarely is heard a discouraging word and all that sort of thing.
Well, you're saying it's one of the friendliest destinations on North American continent.
And part of the reason, and a part of the interconnectedness between the people and the landscape is... and that's why it is one of the friendliest destinations I've been to, because the people in Saskatchewan have had to learn, because of the great spaces, because of great boom and bust times, especially the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl of the Dirty 30s, which, was happening in the United States as well as Canada, and the boom times, this is the breadbasket of the world. The great wheat fields, but they had to learn to stick together in an environment in which they were far apart from each other. That is the nature of the Great Plains.
Mm-hmm.
And so what developed in Saskatchewan was a culture, a highly cooperative culture. It's a place where, even on a governmental level, the cooperative movement, which started in Europe, really took hold. And this was where people worked together. For example, they established credit unions. Saskatchewan, even today, has government auto insurance, government telephone system called SaskTel, and it even has a government-run energy corporation. But what emerged also from Saskatchewan and from this lifestyle of we've got to be cooperative, we've got to be collaborative, we've got to have a communal lifestyle, what emerged was what many people point to in Canada as one of our greatest achievements in this nation, and that is healthcare, universal healthcare, hospital and Medicare. And
that's something that we should look at in this country, actually.
Well, you have and you continue to, and you know, there are all kinds of people that lead the way on that. But Saskatchewan is where that all started. And I want to talk to you. I want to go, first of all, to the capital of Regina, which is a beautiful city out in the middle of the prairie. And as I say in my article, it's, I give Regina my vote for the most contextual and successfully integrated urban setting and design. This city, a beautiful, beautiful city, that manages to blend with the natural environment, with the prairie. And when you go there, and I hope lots of people do, because, as I said, this is the next big discovery in the travel industry in North America and elsewhere. When you go there and to Regina, look at the beautiful trees in these tree-lined, shady streets. Every one of those trees is not indigenous to the prairie. They were brought in and they were hand-planted. But they have built that city, like so much of Saskatchewan, to blend with the natural environment.
But unlike a lot of other areas with wide open land, in southern Saskatchewan, one of the big advantages was the lands were very fertile, of course, weren't they?
Exactly, and that's where geology and time, and here I point out, when I get to the point in the article about the Qu'Appelle Valley, I point out that you have to imagine the last great glacier on the continent retreating north across the Great Plains. And as that, you know, and just imagine the power of this great glaciation process as it retreated across the land, and of course it deposited topsoil. It also left all kinds of rivers and natural smaller water areas. Saskatchewan, by the way, there's a lot of water in Saskatchewan, certainly in the water table, but also people tend to think of it. We have that fixed notion, as I said in my editorial on the website. We have a fixed notion of areas and of Saskatchewan, for example, of being this totally flat land. And there are great areas where it is true you can sit and watch your dog run away for 3 days. But there are a lot of areas in Saskatchewan, especially in the north, where the terrain is quite different. But it's the interplay of geology, time, and human culture, especially the Aboriginal culture. And I go into this to a fair extent in this article because the Great Plains, both in what is now Canada and the United States, the Great Plains were where the Aboriginal people lived off the land, lived off the buffalo, and lived in a very unique environment. Am I talking too fast here?
No. Go right ahead. I'm letting you run with it because you're obviously you put a lot of time into this.
This whole area, you know, was once the bottom of a sea. And once that sea retreated millions of years ago, and then the ice ages started and the glacier retreated, and it left an area that, as I said, became the breadbasket of the world.
Now, how about architecture and those sorts of things, Bob?
Yeah, you look at some of the pictures on the website that I've put up there. Let me talk about three different things. First of all, there's the classic hotel architecture of the great Canadian Railway hotels, and I had the good fortune to stay in two of them. And on the website, in the article, there's an interview with Stéphane Dupré, who is the director of marketing of the Delta Bessborough in Saskatoon. And he's also, like so many people from Saskatchewan, he really has his pulse on the history of the place. And I interviewed him, and he'll tell you about that. You will find in Saskatchewan classic chateau-style hotels. You also find very modern architecture, and this is especially true in downtown Regina. They do this great thing with steel and glass buildings that actually reflect the colors of the prairies. And that's how I started the article, because I was there in early June. It had been a wet spring, and the prairie was the most multicolored I think it's probably been in a long time. There was every shade of green in the natural palette because of the wet spring. The canola was ripe, and it was this brilliant gold. And then there were the fields. I don't know whether you've ever seen fields of, oh, heck, I'm going to forget the name, of flax, lavender-colored flax.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And what the towns and the cities do, and the First Nations cultures as well, somewhat like New Mexico, they reflect all those colors and all those textures.
Yeah,
in
absolutely.
The land.
Yeah, gorgeous, yes.
Yeah. And that's very obvious in the pictures I chose.
Well, and we might just take a moment to mention once again that for those that have access to their computer, if they go to the site TTRN, or if you're on the site listening to the show, just go to this article, which is on Destination Canada, and the photos are spectacular. And as Bob just mentioned, there are even some audio clips on some interviews that he did with some of the people that he's just mentioned. But continue on, Bob. I'm sorry.
Well, I wanted to sort of developed my own Saskatchewan motto when I went out there, which is anticipate everything, be surprised by nothing. It was for me a reconnecting. It really was very much a rediscovering a part of Canada that I'm a little bit ashamed, not a lot, but a little bit ashamed to say that I didn't know that well. And I went there with a fixed notion of Saskatchewan, the prairies, etc. And when I discovered the integration of people, culture, and land, it really resonated with me. I remember this one point, Roy. I'm heading north from Regina to Saskatoon on what's called the Louis Riel Trail, and explain all about Louis Riel in the article. And it is the typical prairie road that it goes straight north. And you, literally as far as the eye can see, and you're moving along. It's as if you are not moving. The road is moving you along, and it's as if the prairie on either side of the road is like two. I call them buffer zones, and it's as if they're putting a gentle pressure on you and on the road to move you forward. And that is the nature of the prairie.
Yeah, I've experienced that. In fact, there's sometimes where there's a gully or a dip, and as you start going up, it really looks like your car. If you stop for a moment, it looks like your car is going backwards instead
That's
of forward.
Right. That's right. And much of the prairie landscape is I'm not sure I'd call it an optical illusion, but it is definitely an optical trick. And just the distances, for example, you know, I'm talking about those highways that are straight lines, and yet there's that optical illusion, if you like, where
the
ribbon of highway comes together at one point. And then off in the distance, you will see, and again, back to architecture, I know I'm going all over the place, but this is kind of a prairie experience too, you will see some of the few remaining grain elevators. And because the communities were separate and somewhat far apart.
Now, by grain elevators, you mean silos?
It's more than that. It's a very distinctive form of architecture. Actually, it's recognized as, and some of these grain elevators are recognized as almost works of art, and I've put a couple of pictures up there on the website, and when you look at them, you'll see that these are places where, yes, the farmers brought their wheat, brought their grains, and stored them, and then the railways came to the grain elevators and picked them up.
Right.
The traditional conventional ones, of course, are made of wood, and they have a very distinctive shape And when you're driving across the flatter part of the prairie, you see in the distance one of these grain elevators, and it's as if it's moving towards you. And this is, it's a part of this landscape that, it's a landscape that comes to you. It's a landscape that invites you to be part of it. And I'm going to change locales a little bit now, and I'm going to go to the Capel Valley. The Capel Valley, think of it as this 250-mile trench that the retreating glacier carved out. And it moves from northeast to southwest across the province. And in a true sense of the word, it's a true valley with the Saskatchewan River running through it. The Capel Valley River running through it, and it's an oasis. It's called the Oasis of the Prairies, and I was there one day, and driving through the, and I stopped on this hill, this undulating hill, overlooking Echo Lake. It's called, and I'm sitting there, Roy, on the edge in the grasses of the prairie. And I know you'll understand this because you and your daughter Tiffany are horse people, and I'm a horse person, et cetera. And you'll understand. I'm sitting there with my back to the barbed wire fence, and I hear this quiet sound. And I turn around, and here is a mini herd of about four or five horses, a couple of mares and foals coming up behind me. And I swear, I know I'm being anthropomorphic here, but they came up to say, welcome to the prairie. And then...
Why did I think you were going to say that?
Yeah, and then, I swear this is true, a bird lands on the top wire of the fence, and I think it's a meadowlark. I didn't have the chance to check this out, but I'm pretty sure it is. The photograph is on the website. If it's not a meadowlark, please, someone...
Send us an email and find out, because Bob's an incurable romantic, so you'll...
Yeah, it is, but that's what romance is.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing that I've learned from my experience in Saskatchewan, too, is that all travel is narrative, and the landscape is narrative. The stories are there. All you have to be able to do is...
Look and listen.
Interpret them.
Yeah, exactly.
And the signs are all there, but it's part of... And, you know, I think it reaffirmed for me, too, that this is what we're doing in Talking Travel. We are, and Carol's piece that I was just listening to, wonderful, you know, and Carol is so good at that. It's all about the story, the narrative, and it's timeless.
And the feeling, as you say, is so different. I can remember one time where I was in the Nevada desert, yeah, I was looking around, and it's the first time I had been in that area, and an elderly lady came over to me, and she said, "Well, you look disappointed." And I said, "Well, I'm not disappointed, but I you know, it's just so different." She said, "Well, you must come from a green area." And
yeah.
I said, "Yes." And
yeah.
She said, "Well, yeah. But if you look in and spend enough time, you will see the beauty in the brown and the other colors."
Yeah.
And she was absolutely right. But you have to stop, as you say, and take a moment and dwell on it and think about it and get the feeling. And that's what it's all about.
And I want to mention, if I could, because a book, a very, very special book that I was reading while I was out there, and I put quotes into the article. From the book, the title of which is River in a Dry Land, A Prairie Passage. And at one point, it's written by Trevor Harriet, and I've given the link there where you can see a review of the book. At one point, he's talking about the Capel Valley that I was just referring to, and he says the following: "The valley itself, a relatively moist corridor or prairie, aspiring to be woodland, is a refuge from the arid domain above, a hiding place from the unceasing wind." And this is the part I really love. "It appears to the traveler as a wandering line of returnings, a shelter you leave and rejoin and leave again." And I think he could be talking about all natural spaces. And as we become a much more urbanized world, a much more urbanized society, we we, of necessity, like the people of Saskatchewan, we start to redevelop, reconnect with the land and with the landscape. And in other words, we return to it because, let's face it, folks, that if we screw up in terms of the environment, there it goes. There's not going to be anything left.
Well,
but these are the lessons of the landscape that you get from Saskatchewan.
Now, just if we can for a moment, after appreciating all of this, and we get a little tired maybe and a little hungry, how about the food?
Well, especially, well, I had some great meals. Believe me, I had some great meals. In Regina, and I've given a reference here to a wonderful restaurant called The Willow on Wascana. Regina is built around an enormous, huge space in a man-made lake. Have you ever had bison mousse as an appetizer?
Not as an appetizer.
Okay,
no.
Well, I'll make it for you someday. You know, I'll have to get the buffalo or the bison.
I'll take you up on that one. I've had some buffalo, yes.
Yeah.
But,
how about trout sushi?
Oof. No, yeah. That sounds wonderful.
Anyway, but whenever I go west in Canada, I always enjoy a good meal of beef. And in Saskatoon, I give the link for the restaurant there, too. It's a great restaurant that established by a Greek family that emigrated to the West, and this is also very much a part of the Saskatchewan experience. It is that westward movement. It is the immigration. It's a mixed blessing too, and it's part of the history, and it's part of what I'm writing about in this story. When cultures clash, when the non-prairie culture meets the prairie culture, there's a fair amount of negotiation happening.
The other good
thing about dining in Saskatchewan or just getting to know the people in Saskatchewan is that you take your time.
Right.
This is not a fast food country.
And as you say, in a nutshell, Saskatchewan is the kind of unique physical environment in which the individual can reconnect to basic values in life, to land, and to oneself.
You couldn't have said it better. But I want to end with a quote, if I could, Roy. Do you know the folk singer Joni Mitchell?
Mm-hmm.
Very famous, very famous. She's an icon in the music industry. She grew up in Saskatoon, in Saskatchewan, and she's known for a number of classic tunes. One of them is a song called Both Sides Now, and a very famous refrain that goes, I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from
yes,
up
I've
down,
heard, yes.
And still somehow, it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. But you know what? She does. And that song and that refrain is very much the sense of reconnecting that I think Saskatchewan is all about. So everyone, start to plan your summer vacation and look north. Go to the website. Check out. I've even put in a couple of maps there, a topographical map for you. No problem. And let's all get together in Saskatchewan.
And have some sushi.
Yeah,
and some bison
mousse. Spread it on a cracker.
Sounds good to me. Bob, wonderful report. And again, to those that are listening, if you go to Destination Canada, scroll down to Bob's article, and you can see the beautiful photos and read his article in depth. We've got to go. I thank you once again, and, I know I'll be talking to you again soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob. Bye
see
for now.
Later. Bye-bye.
Well, Bob Fisher, and wonderful, a wonderful story, wonderful article. We've got to go, and let's just see what we've got here. You can check out our program schedule by going to ttrn.com for the latest guest information. And next week, guests are Peter Flaherty, Suzanne Wright, Johnny Jett. So tune in at 11 a.m. next Wednesday to the Travel Talk Radio Network. And this is Roy Lowy saying bye for now. No.